Hello. This podcast could be called 9 points about financial regulation. Just wanted to tease out nine, because they're just nine that have occurred to me when I decided to put down a list, of ways in which we might come at a discussion of financial regulation, or you might come at it if you were writing about it. So just, you know, nine different ways of either, you know, nine completely different points, or any one of these could form a central theme to an essay. And what you're being asked to do, really, is to read and think about the material for yourselves. There's certainly no intention to be dirigiste about telling you what to write at all. Rather, we're putting up a cloud of ideas for you to have a look at them, to think about them, and try and assimilate them as you find that interesting. Now, in talking about financial regulation, there's the core themes that we've looked at so far. But we're also going to move into conduct of business regulation, the regulation of insider dealing and market abuse. So we're going to be talking about financial regulation explicitly for a while, but we're going to keep talking about it and how it interacts with substantive law in later topics as well. And then we're going to come back to it. We'll look at banking regulation and the banking crisis towards the end of the course. So I think it's one of those things that you should be trying to pull together your own interest, your own perspective on how all this functions. So number one of nine, what is regulation for? I think this is a key question, really, is what do we think regulation is about? If you're studying this course at Queen Mary, you are, by definition, thinking about jurisprudence as well. You're thinking about positivist law, law that gives us commands. You're thinking about law that is something based on morality, natural law. So you should be trying to think, well, you know, how does regulation fit into that? Is it really law at all? Because it's not activated through a court. There are no judges that sit in relation to this regulation. Rather, we have the Financial Services Authority itself, with its own FSA Markets Tribunal, which is discussed in Chapter 9 in the book. So we don't, certainly at the minute, we don't have very much case law. We have scraps that are discussed in chapters 8 and 9 of the textbook, but we don't have very much on how should this work and whether or not this is really law. So what could it be about instead? Well, it could be about economics. It could be that financial regulation has as much to do with the economic management of financial markets, with the integrity of the financial system, given that it's this financial system that produces so much of the cash that we need in the real economy. Or we might try and separate off all this speculative investment and financial activity from ordinary banking, which is the lifeblood of people's mortgages, business having enough cash to see them through until they get paid by their customers. We might say there's banking on the one hand and there's investment activity on the other, and maybe our economic focus should be on one rather than the other, and that financial regulation should be trying to damp down investment and speculative activity. So there's a lot of economic questions there. One of the roles of the FSA is to look to market confidence. And I think that's interesting. So much banking is built on confidence, as we've seen through 2008 and 2009. As soon as ordinary people lose confidence in a bank, the bank falls, like Northern Rock. As soon as other banks lose confidence in a bank, like Lehman Brothers, it falls. All banks are technically insolvent. None of them have enough cash to meet all of their obligations as they become due. I mean, no one in this world in that sense is solvent, anyone with a mortgage. It's very rare for anyone with a mortgage to be able to pay their mortgage off. If you had enough cash to do that, to pay it off immediately, you wouldn't have needed the mortgage to start with. You know, people can pay their mortgages off over time. So does that mean they're insolvent now because they can't pay their debt immediately? Everyone, we assume not, because the world couldn't function otherwise. But it's such a fragile thing. It requires us all to think, oh, well, this person will pay this off eventually. Ditto banks. And eventually, in the US, everyone just seems to have lost patience with Lehman Brothers and looked at the fact that they had $44 of exposure for every dollar they actually owned, and eventually realised this was not sustainable, and Lehman had to be treated as being insolvent, and had to be broken up and sold off. That regulation is about education is an interesting idea. It suggests a very Americanization, sorry, a very interesting Americanization of UK financial markets. Very common in the US for Americans to invest in companies. Even back in the 1929 crash, the number of ordinary investors that there were, remarkable. And the Americans really do look to ordinary citizens to invest as well as large institutions. Now, so the idea that you're going to educate the populace as to how this works suggests that you are looking to the populace ever more to be participants in financial markets. So number one, what's regulation for? It seems to have a lot of goals that aren't the same goals straightforwardly as a legal system which compensates or punishes or whatever else. And there's a separate podcast on all of that overlap between regulation and substantive law. Point two, why is financial regulation so unlike other areas of law? And I think this follows on from exactly that first point, the point we were just making there, that the goals of financial regulation aren't goals of providing damages, compensation, and so forth straightforwardly. Financial regulation doesn't promise to save you from loss and to compensate loss, other than in particular circumstances like Section 19 and securities fields that we'll come to later in the course. Rather, financial regulation seems to insist that you are treated appropriately and that you are given certain types of information, typically accurate financial information about any entity in which you're going to invest. And then it's up to you. Now, that's not the kind of, I think, protection that people often think they're going to get from a regulator. You see FSA regulated on the bottom of something and you think, oh, well, there's an adult there to look after me if it all goes wrong. And that's not really what financial regulation is about. So financial regulation has different goals from other areas of law, I think it can be said, at many levels. A third point, what do we think about high-level principles? You know, they seem to be vague. And is that a good or a bad thing? It permits flexibility. It makes it difficult for financial institutions to know what their obligations are at many levels. However, it also makes financial institutions think about how they should behave and what their obligations ought to be. So that might be thought to be a good thing. Beyond that question of vagueness, which I've discussed on other podcasts, are these high-level principles a realistic recognition of how finance works in practice? Is it just about saying financial markets are so complex, so innovative, and so fast-moving that we can only operate at a high level in that sense? Directives should operate at the highest level possible, and that it needs technocrats like the Commission to provide more detailed regulation at a lower or deeper level. But is that in itself an admission of defeat? Have we decided that the legislative process simply can't control financial markets? I mean, after all, if law is supposed to be sovereign on a positivist model, shouldn't the law be able simply to dictate? What are we doing as financial regulators if we're suddenly deciding, well, we need a model that allows the law to react to where the market's going? Why can't the law just say, no, be like this, and this is the only way you're allowed to be? It's a straightforwardly political question. It's a question of naked political power, as between, on the one hand, the financial regulators and the governments that stand behind them, and a market that wants to be free, that wants to innovate, that wants to seek profit wherever it can. And financial markets, in many instances, like to move to jurisdictions where there is light-touch regulation or no regulation at all. So there's a huge difference between ordinary taking of deposits, making loans on the one hand, through to financial derivatives transactions that happen outside exchanges and shadowy financial products which are created simply to avoid tax and done through tax haven jurisdictions like the Cayman Islands and so on and so forth. There's a lot going on there, and maybe there's some kind of recognition that all of this simply exists beyond law. So we need to think about whether that's true and to what extent that's true and problematic. Fourth point, can regulation be done only internationally? One of the messages we might have got from the global financial crisis is that there needs to be more international cooperation if we're going to regulate financial markets properly. Of course, what happened internationally wasn't regulation of financial markets. It was governments and central bankers coming together to try and figure out how do they coordinate their response to things having gone wrong. So quantitative easing, recapitalisation of banks around the world, which Gordon Brown was instrumental in moving, to be fair to Gordon. That international cooperation in times of crisis was important. Can we rebuild that sort of cooperation, if you like, in peacetime? We'll wait and we'll see. Or will the kind of nationalism that did poke through, I mean, the fact that each individual jurisdiction wanted to save its own banks, the Germans wanted to get in with Hypobank, the French were very keen to get in, and looked at Société Générale and BNP and other French banks. The Swiss had to intercede to deal with UBS and Credit Suisse. You know, there was a lot of nationalism going on there as well. In that level, the EU has been quite important. But is there a need now to have an EU regulator rather than just an EU legislative process? 5. Is risk assessment really the same as regulation or the same as law? Because what really goes on amongst the banks is that they look to measure risks mathematically. And this has been one of the problems with Lehman Brothers, has been the realisation ex post facto that Lehman Brothers was taking incredibly aggressive assumptions about the value of many of its products and the size of its exposure. One of the things that seems to have come out is that a lot of other institutions simply would have valued Lehman's exposure at a very different level from the way Lehman was itself. And that's problematic. You know, we just then have a question then about mathematical models. Because all these models are doing are predicting the future on the basis of past effects and also trying to build into those models some element of risk. It's incredibly complicated maths in which no one can know definitively the answer. So everyone's making their best guess. And that's problematic, just from within banks. Now the thing is, that the methodology that's taken, for example, through the supervision manual in the FSA handbook, the SUP manual, is that the FSA itself also works on risk modelling. It looks at how well banks are performing, effectively runs kind of computer-modelled war games about how individual banks would react. And a lot of the stress testing that went on in 2009 in New York and in London by the regulators was trying to guess, given the exposure of these banks to various markets, how much danger are they in if particular economic scenarios play out. And so regulators, it seems, before the crash, were far too laid back about the modelling they were doing and whether or not they were really anticipating worst-case scenarios, whereas after the crash now everyone's assuming a worst-case scenario of a huge market player falling down and the whole system seizing up. So there's a problem there on relying too much on risk assessment and maths. From a lawyer's perspective, you'd like some rules, you'd like some analysis, which isn't built on supposition, which is built on principle, which is built on rule. And that's two very different ways of thinking about the universe. Are you thinking about it in terms of rules, or are you going to think about it in terms of abstract mathematical assumptions, mathematical theories, and so on and so forth? Of course, a mathematician would look at law and say, but it's all so uncertain and fuzzy around the edges, and all these principles and how they'll play out. At least with maths, you know what the answer is. The trouble is your mathematical calculations, in financial market terms, are always built on assumptions about where you think the market will be in the future, where you think interest rates will be, whether you think liquidity will still be available between banks, and all those sorts of things that went wrong from the summer of 2007 onwards. At 6, why do we regulate authorised firms and not entire market sectors? It's always been a bugbear of mine. I don't know why regulators don't just decide to regulate anything that's a derivative. Instead of having to be quite so cautious about how you define the products that you're going to regulate, and then regulating individual people who deal in those products, and that makes a lot of sense in itself. But why can't we just say we're going to regulate anything that goes on in that market? So that hedge funds, for example, which have existed hitherto outside the regulatory net, although the EC is now proposing a directive to regulate hedge funds, why can't we just say anyone who is a participant in this market falls to be regulated? You know, the fact that you come here means you are to be watched, a bit like CCTV. If you walk into the market square, you're caught on CCTV. At the minute, what we're doing in effect is saying we're only going to regulate people who walk into that market square who are performing a particular type of activity. So we're only going to regulate the people in red shirts, and it's as though everyone else is invisible to our kind of regulatory CCTV. I'd much prefer the idea that we're watching everyone that's in that marketplace, whether they're a seller, whether they're acting in the course of business or not. 7, following on, is regulation really about people and not rules? Something that seems to have come out of the financial crisis, I would suggest, is that while we can have a lengthy rule book with all kind of principles in it, like the principle that thou shalt act with integrity, which was always in the old Securities Investments Board, SIB, rule book, before 2000. I mean, the idea of integrity has been around financial regulation for a long time. It seems to me that what is really important are the people involved. You know, are the bankers and the traders obeying these regulations? Or are they merely going through a show of compliance? Are they pretending to bend the knee? Or is there genuine compliance going on there? And the regulators themselves, no matter how stroppy the rule book may look, you know, are they actually getting close enough to regulated firms? Are they actually regulating them sufficiently closely? So I think this is something there about this being about people and about practice and about implementation, every bit as much as it is about rules. And that's messy for us as lawyers, because of course as lawyers we like to look at how the rules work. We tend to study substantive principle. And it's far more difficult to measure how those rules seem to work in practice. It all becomes a bit anecdotal, a bit messy. We prefer principle and rule, but the fact it might be about people makes things a bit more difficult. 8. Is regulation of information flows and conduct of business really the same as investor protection? All we're really doing with financial regulation is ensuring there's enough information there. And as we're going to see in our next topic, conduct of business regulation, we require firms to classify their clients and to treat them suitably. But that's all to do with risk warnings, that's all to do with making sure there's enough information out there. It's not about shielding and protecting ordinary retail investors, ordinary members of the public with no particular expertise. So when we talk about investor protection, as people tend to, I'm not convinced that what the regulations are really aimed at is their protection. I think it's aimed at informing them and making sure that they haven't been treated badly, but then they're entirely on their own. And so we might think this just responds to a very old-fashioned contract law idea of caveat emptor, perhaps. Let the buyer beware. As long as we've treated that buyer appropriately, suitably to start with, we've spotted they need to have the risk explained to them and they've been explained to them, then we just leave them to their own devices. It's up to you then to decide what to do. And this may be familiar to you if you think about undue influence in Barclays Bank and O'Brien and all those cases in land law in relation to mortgages, which we'll talk about later in the course. That idea that you can simply give someone some advice and then sit back and watch what they do, that seems to be how we're working here as well. And again, do we want to protect people, particularly if we're going to encourage them to invest more and more, we're going to require them to take out private pensions and instead of the state stepping in to help? You know, are we going to put more and more people in a position where they feel they have to engage in financial markets, whereas otherwise they might not voluntarily have done so? And so I think that's something we need to kick around and just think about what is it we're seeking to do when we talk about investor protection. 9, the point I raised in the lecture, the regulations have changed frequently. Look at securities regulation, it's changed like 4 times completely since 1996. There was a complete rewriting of the Stock Exchange rules in 97. Then we have the Financial Services and Markets Act in 2000, requiring changes to all the regulatory approaches in 2002, 2005 and 2007 in the UK. Now that's regular and rapid change, and a lot of those changes were seismic changes, completely new directives coming in at the European level. So that even when the FSA was tinkering with its regulation nationally, we knew that there was yet more change to come, because we knew that the new EC directives would be implemented in the UK only a couple of years afterwards. So does it really help us in financial markets to know and to think about what these rules are if they keep changing rapidly and seismically? Now you might say financial markets are built on rapid change, and this is just another aspect of the things they're going to have to get used to. But I think it's an important one to think about. If we keep changing these regulations so fast in their detail, then it's difficult for them to bed in, for professionals to know where they stand, and maybe it's not the best way to proceed. A lot of commercial law, people are always asking the question, is there sufficient certainty in these rules so that people know what they're doing? The Companies Act 2006, for example, in its Code on Directors' Duties, sees it as something that's very desirable, that directors, ordinary directors, not lawyers, should know what their obligations, what their duties are. And so that code is written in statute for the first time, always been in case law before, and written in very approachable English as well, not too much legalese really for a statute. So on the one hand we have a recognition that commercial people should be able to understand this stuff. Brackets, the irony of the 2006 Companies Act is how huge it is, close bracket. And yet, financial regulation keeps changing rapidly, and keeps changing from the roots up. And so we've not just got the problems of watching what's going on in financial markets and keeping up to date with that. We've also got the problem of the regulation and the law changing underneath, and us needing to keep up with that as well. And you can't help but wonder, it might do us all good for a while, just for things to just carry on normally for a year or so and just settle down and bed in. So that was 9 points, some ideas about financial regulation that might give you ways in to thinking about some of this stuff and about writing about it. Later podcasts will talk far more about the fun macro-political stuff that blows out the financial crisis. But I think those are some ideas there that you can use to think about financial regulation and really to jab at it and get at it and think about how it works. Bye-bye now.